Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And today I am joined by another wonderful guest who actually reached out to me, and I'm so glad she did because she has so much to offer the Neurodiverse Love community. And I'd like to welcome Jackie Schold to the podcast. Welcome, Jackie.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's going to be a great conversation. I'm glad you're here. And I usually start out the conversation with my guests, kind of asking them to introduce themselves and also to share a little bit about their story. So I know you have a very interesting story, but if you want to kind of share what brought you to do the work you're doing and any information about your story, I'm sure the audience would love to hear it.
Yeah. So I am an art therapist and a mental health counselor, but I primarily work as an art therapist, and I specialize in late identified autism. And this became my area of specialization because I myself am a late identified autistic. I first learned I might be autistic from my own art therapist. Mm. And at the time, I was like, no way, because what I knew about autism was basically what's in the diagnostic and statistics manual, which is what we're trained on in graduate school. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I do not know. No, I am not like that. And then my therapist suggested I read Divergent Mind. Mm-hmm. And that book really provided a look at what autism can look like from the inside, meaning what your thoughts are like, what you're feeling like versus your external behaviors. And so that was when I started to realize like, oh, I might be autistic. And then as I learned more, I was like, okay, I'm definitely autistic. And then eventually went for a formal diagnosis where I was formally diagnosed with autism and ADHD.
Isn't it so interesting how, you know, somebody else points out something to us and we may be accepting, or we're like, oh, okay, this explains some things. Let me do some more research. Or, you know, I've heard lots of folks who totally negate, you know, what is shared with them and may do some research later on. I've even heard folks, and this is really sad, share that their parents knew they were autistic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hear this from folks in the couple support group that I run, and they never told their child because of the stigma attached to it. And it's so sad, you know, to me that that those folks have not known that this was a part of their lives and why they functioned maybe very differently than others. So thank you so much for that. So how old were you when you discovered that you were autistic ADHD?
I was in my mid-30s.
Okay. And I think that is more common today. And thank God for TikTok and, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all the social media that's out there, because, and YouTube, because that's how a lot of people are self-identifying and they're realizing that they are not so different. They are neurodivergent. And it can lead to so much peace and joy. And it sounds like you've found both of those. So tell me a little bit, Jackie, about the work you do with neurodivergent folks, because you don't work with couples, if I remember correctly.
No.
Okay.
No. In my internship training and then a little bit afterwards, I did work with couples and, you know, families as well, but holy smokes, it's too difficult for me, for who I am, and trying to attend to two people at once and make sure they're both okay. It's not my strong suit.
Sure.
So
sure.
I admire what you do. But for myself, I really work best with individuals who are either exploring if they could be autistic or they just found out that they are autistic. And they're like, well, what does that mean for me? And where do I go from here? So we are often looking at topics like, what are your autistic characteristics? And given what those are, how do you work with your brain? And what parts do you need to accept about yourself? And what parts can you maybe change a little bit? Or what parts can't you change at all?
That is so important. And, you know, I don't know that I've ever really talked in depth about those issues on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is something that I do address in the support groups that I facilitate, because oftentimes when we don't know who we are because we've been masking or people pleasing, or we've been in a state of kind of fawn or freeze, or even fight, you know, our nervous system has been constantly dysregulated. And then we find out, like, I self-identify as ADHD, big time, big time, big time. I have now an 8-page resume. There's a reason I didn't stay at jobs for more than 2 to 3 years, because I got so bored. And now accepting myself, because I always thought I was so different in that way, I just love the dopamine hits. I love variety. And it has allowed me to love myself in ways that I don't think I did as a younger person, you know? So I love also that you're helping folks with art. So let's talk a little bit about how you help folks understand what things are a part of their neurodiversity, what things are just a part of their personality, what things or traits are things that may never change, which may be changeable if they decide they're things that they want to work on. Is there a process you go through? How do you use art? Maybe you can share a little bit about all of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's one thing to be able to talk with someone about autism and, you know, get clear, relatable information. But then it's an entirely different thing to really sit with it and process it. We as autistics, you know, we have this web of thoughts in our minds. I actually call it constellation thinking, where you have like one thought and then it's connected to a bunch of other thoughts. And so it's very, I think, exhausting when you first learn you're autistic, because your mind's like trying to make sense of so much. And it's extremely emotional, because you're processing, you know, in one respect, it's relieving and it's a sense of like, wow, I'm not broken. But in another respect, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of grief, and there's a lot of confusion and frustration, and just it's a lot all at once. And art can really help us to move those emotions through us and kind of examine where we need to go next with it all. So for example, if someone is really, really experiencing a lot of anger, I might ask them to grab some magazines and look through for any images that resonate with the anger they're feeling, and just rip them out. And then to lay them all out on a piece of paper and make, you know, so a collage. And then we sit with that image and kind of discuss what's coming up and what inevitably there's like patterns between that, like things that me as an art therapist, I can pick up on pretty quick, or ask, you know, questions about, oh, I'm noticing this, or I see this. And so it's kind of a way, not kind of, it is a way to tap into the subconscious, or what is right below the surface of our emotions. So it helps us go deeper and look at the things that need to be processed in order for that emotion to move through us.
Oh, Jackie, I love that. And again, I think you're the first person to talk about this. I have another person who was my co-host in a previous season, and he also was an artist and then became a therapist. And found out he was autistic, a late self-identified. And so, but we never really talked about this. And as you were talking, it made me think about how when my daughter was little, my ex-husband would draw pictures for her and he would create stories for her. And he was really, really good at that and teaching her lessons through art and music and all of the creative things he had inside of him. And that just wasn't me, but she loved it. And she learned so easily with that different kind of teaching, where I'm a person that likes to sit in a classroom and hear from somebody who's the expert or knowledgeable about a subject, or I like to read about it myself. Mm-hmm. We all learn so differently. But I don't think a lot of therapists take that into account when providing therapy or coaching. And I think what you're describing is going to resonate as a really interesting modality for a lot of the neurodivergent folks out there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So you literally have folks, instead of using words, they are going into magazines and pulling out pictures that describe what they're feeling. What about other ways of expressing themselves through art?
Oh, yes. Like, I mean, there's so many mediums. But I do want to say, I don't see it as art instead of words. I see them, it's with it, because I'm an expressive arts therapist. So sometimes I acknowledge someone needs to write. Like, for instance, I'll have them, if we're still going with the theme of anger, I'll have them make a little clay creature that represents their anger. And then I'll set it in front of them and they have to write what that clay creature wants them to know.
Wow. I love that. I absolutely love that. Okay, so tell me more. So literally, are most of your sessions an hour? Because it's,
yes, right now all my sessions are 60 minutes. I own my own private practice, so I'm lucky enough that I can evolve my practice with time and to what I feel my clients are needing, as well as to where I'm at in my life. So the way I practice right now is I meet with clients once a month for a 60-minute session, and then I give them art activities to do between our sessions. So then when we meet again, we process their art, we talk about where they're at, and then, you know, kind of I give them some new things for the next month.
That is phenomenal. So I had never, until we met, heard of the term expressive art therapist. Mm-hmm. So are there a lot of programs out there that somebody could get a degree in expressive art therapy? Do you know of, you know, others out there? I know you went, is it Prescott?
Mm-hmm. I went to Prescott College. The way they do it there is I got my master's in mental health counseling. Okay. And then I did a certificate, which was like a 60 credit program. So big certificate in expressive arts therapy. And that qualified me to either pursue registration as an art therapist or an expressive arts therapist. And I actually chose to do both. So I'm a board certified art therapist as well as an expressive arts therapist.
Okay. Wow. So clearly you found your passion, you found your niche, and we're talking about how this could be helpful to other autistic or autistic ADHD or other neurodivergent folks. So let's talk a little bit about how you help folks find their kind of happy place in their life, or their peaceful place, or their joyous place. So give me an example of, like, as you meet with a person, let's say for 3 to 6 months, how each month's session could help them get more in touch with themselves and move forward in creating a better life for themselves.
I want to start by saying I know we as therapists always have the end goal of, like, happiness and peace, but that's not actually the goal I set forth.
Okay.
Because someone who's newly identified autistic, like, that is so far in the distance for many of them.
Sure.
Because they're in such a state of, like, whoa, overwhelm, and there's just a lot. So Furthermore, many of us late identified autistics have always put heavy, heavy goals and expectations on ourselves. So I'm trying to free us from that a bit and really more so go for understanding of ourselves and clarity about ourselves and be okay with whatever emotion that may bring. That may mean a whole lot of grief, and that's okay.
Sure.
Because I also think so much of our lives, at least I'll speak more for myself, I just berated myself and judged myself for feeling so much. Like, you know, oh, Jackie, don't be so reactional, or oh, I always have stronger emotions than everyone else. And a huge part of my healing journey has been that, hey, it's okay to have feelings, and I'm having these feelings for a reason. And if I listen to them, they're actually helpful.
That's so, so important. And I think I use those two words, understanding and acceptance, in like many of the Instagram posts that I put out there and in the podcast, because I think, you know, many of us who are neurodivergent or in a neurodiverse relationship, we look at the differences between us and our partners or us and the rest of the world, and we think there's something wrong with us. And if we don't understand why our bodies and our brains work the way they do, then we can't accept ourselves. Right. Yeah. And so, so I hear you. And my ex-husband used to say, I used to say, are you happy? And he never liked that word.
Yeah.
He used to say, I'm content. And I never understood kind of what the difference was for him. But now I understand a lot more. I seek that dopamine hit, which is happiness for a moment. He wanted to be content with life, I think, you know, in many areas. He wasn't searching for that dopamine hit like I was. And I think that a lot of us who are ADHD are constantly searching for that dopamine hit. And that's not what everybody needs. So getting to a place where you can understand yourself, what does that look like for some of the folks that you're working with using expressive art therapy?
A lot of it in the beginning is really looking at their characteristics. And I break them up into six categories of think like mental characteristics, emotional characteristics, sensory system, body, and passions, and social impacts. And so we go in depth in each of those categories to see how autism is showing up for them. And not just like, and I talk a lot about this in the essays I write, that it's not like you have one autistic characteristic that never changes, or we'll say it's always consistent. A lot of times our characteristics increase in frequency during stressful times, or are more intense when our sensory system is overloaded. So there is a lot of psychoeducation that happens as I meet with clients, and that's to help them see themselves and also to see like, hey, what you're experiencing is normal. As well as a lot of newly identified autistics have a lot of self-doubt, like, oh, maybe I'm not autistic, maybe I'm exaggerating, maybe this, maybe that. And so I want to really help lay that question to rest. So while we're doing that, I'm also like, so for instance, let's say we do a whole session on their thinking characteristics. Like, that's great, cool. They have all this information in their head, but their head is still like, oh, that's a lot. And so depending on the person, because I tailor everything about the art to the person, because maybe they work better with tactile things like clay or sand tray, or maybe I find they would do better with details. So depending on who they are, I will design something, but usually it's something like a brain map. Like, hey, I want you to make a bubble map of all these things, all these thinking characteristics. And that's, again, another way for the mind, as they're drawing that out, to go back over it and kind of let it integrate into, you know, their existing networks in their brain, we'll say.
Wow. Okay. As you're sharing all this, Jackie, there's so many light bulbs going off in my head. Seriously, in relation to my marriage and in relation to so many of the individuals and couples that I've worked with, because, you know, I don't understand an autistic brain. I know more now than I did in 2016 when I separated from my ex, but I didn't understand how my ex's brain worked. And I don't think he understood how my brain worked. So if we don't understand all those six characteristics of ourselves, then we may get reactive. We may go into very dysregulated states with our nervous system. And I know for lots of folks, the challenge is when you get to that point where your nervous system is really dysregulated because you don't understand yourself or your partner, it can take hours, days, weeks, and sometimes even months to come back, right? To be at a state of equilibrium or homeostasis. So can you repeat again? I wrote down four of the characteristics. So I have mental, emotional, sensory, and social. I didn't get the other two.
When I call them categories, because within each, there's, you know, countless characteristics.
Okay.
But I believe the two, body.
Body, okay. Nope.
I'm sorry, I'll just have to do it again in my head.
Yeah, that's
mental,
okay.
Mental, emotional, sensory, body. Oh, passions.
Passions. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you call them categories. So let's talk a little bit about each one, if you don't mind. Okay. And I think I'm going to start with passions, because I know this is an area, and maybe you can just give me an example or two in each, of how there can be a struggle for a newly identified or diagnosed autistic or autistic ADHD person, and what are some of the things that you help them understand and accept so they can value and appreciate those parts of themselves. So passion, maybe one or two things. Yeah.
I will do my best. I usually can't multitask, like keep two questions in my head at once. Okay. So please interrupt and remind me. So passions, it's so funny. No one ever starts there, but like, I love starting there because usually this category is called special interests by other people. But I find that to be misleading because people have a conceptualization of that. Like it means you are so obsessed with something that you don't do anything else. And that's not fully accurate. Like, we're adults, we have lives, and sometimes we don't get times with our passions because we have family obligations or we have to go to work. And so that's one reason I like it, as well as special interests is just a bit condescending. Like, oh, you special thing, you have your special interests.
Right, right.
It's like, no, I just have passions. And so the main thing I like to emphasize in this category is that it's one of the main ways we regulate our nervous systems. Mm-hmm. Neurotypical individuals can co-regulate with other people, meaning just by being in the presence of another calm human, their nervous system can begin to regulate. And that's not the case with autistics. We do object-focused regulation, meaning if we're doing a task by ourselves, that's what regulates our nervous system. So sorry, I hear you taking a breath.
No, that again, there's so many epiphanies that are going to come out of this podcast because I never understood this. And I mean, I do now, but I never understood this in my marriage. And it used to bug the heck out of me that my ex could sit in a room by himself in front of a computer for hours, if not a whole day. Yeah. And do kind of the same things over and over again every weekend. And I'd be like, you already worked on that. Why are you working on it again? Why are you revising it? I just didn't get it. And I would want to spend time with him. One of my love languages was quality time because that's how I regulated. And oh my gosh, did that turn into so many arguments, Jackie? And I say this, I share my personal experience because I hear it over and over and over again from couples and individuals who are not autistic. So that's a really important one. So what do you tell folks? I'm sure many of the folks you work with are in relationships.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So you may not do couples therapy, but what do you tell them when they're in relationship with a partner, or they have a partner and kids or whatever, how to have some balance between their passions and the other people in their lives?
Sorry, I had another thought.
Go ahead. Go. I'm flowing. We're flowing. Yeah.
But one thing when I'm working on this category with people is that I want them to learn how to take care of their brains so that they don't get to places of overwhelm and burnout as frequently. So, in fact, many of the people I work with, they're not taking enough alone time with their passions to really get their nervous systems regulated. So there's that fact, right? And then the other fact that, like, we're in family systems that need our time and attention and that we want to be in. And so, you know, two coexisting, sometimes contradictory things can be true. And so a lot of times I'm talking my clients through how to explain this to their significant others. Because again, it's that understanding that often makes the difference. Like when their partner understands, oh, I don't have to take this personally that you want to be alone. And that's another key thing here that many non-autistic people don't understand is that the presence of another person in the room significantly decreases our ability to regulate our nervous system.
And that's what, stop right there. If you can't stop right there.
Yeah.
Because that will be life-changing for some folks. Okay. I know that now, Jackie. I did not know that for 29 years. Okay. That's big. So when our partners who are autistic or autistic ADHD walk out of the room to re-regulate, it's not personal. But I think this is the what I try to share in the couple support groups, understanding this before you're dysregulated or before you're in a fight or before you're overwhelmed, and having this conversation and this understanding can be the difference between, and I swear, you know, if I had known all this stuff, I don't know where I'd be today, but I don't think I would have started Neurodiverse Love, but I think knowing the difference between what each partner's brain and body needs to regulate can be life-changing.
And this is happening, this being like another person alerting your nervous system, because autistic brains are hyper alert. And so when another person is in the room, our brain is observing them and like picking up on so many details. And so that's why our nervous system can't relax. It has nothing to do with who they are. It could be the person that makes me the happiest in the world, like, and I will still need time away from them so I can calm down.
Oh, Jackie. You actually just teared me up with that one, because that's what I hear so often from couples that are on the verge of divorce, or if they're living together and in a committed relationship on the verge of separating and ending the relationship, because they don't understand that love isn't defined the same way for each of them. And there's so much unintentional hurt. Because they don't understand that. Oh, that's powerful. Go ahead.
When I do want to say, even my own husband and I, you know, when we first started living together, he wanted to, for dinner, well, it was after dinner, he wanted to just watch a movie together.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't necessarily want to cuddle, or he just wanted us to both sit side by side on the couch and watch a movie. And I was like, oh my God, this is so boring. Like, I was just, but for him, that quality time was so important. And then, but for me, it was the opposite. It was like, can't I be doing my art? Can't I be doing something to keep my brain engaged? I personally just don't like movies. And so that was really something we had to work through in our marriage, even already knowing, like, he knew I was autistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it was still something we kind of had to figure out.
Yeah. And thank goodness that you know this, because you just got married, right? And you
moved in with each other
recently.
Yep.
So, mm-hmm. you know, you're very fortunate that you knew this at the beginning of your relationship, so you could both understand each other's needs and wants and preferences and share that with each other, so that you could accept how you're each wired differently rather than looking at the differences as ongoing challenges. Right.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and you're part of the lost generation, Jackie, you know, you're part of that generation that did not get looked at in school as potentially having some differences that you may have needed accommodations for. And I'm not even the lost generation. I don't know what I am, but, you know, but you know, those of us, I'll be 60 in a month. So, we got totally lost, but the thing is you're both open to understanding each other. And that's so important. So the passion piece is really, really important. And I think it's a big challenge, a humongous, I'm not even gonna say big, it's a humongous challenge for a lot of folks. And I love the way you explained it. And I think it's going to be very helpful to a lot of the listeners. I wanna move on to the emotional category, because that's a category where I hear a lot of division, a lot of conflict, and a lot of challenges. So what are some of the things that you can share about that that might be helpful?
So without a doubt, autistics, and I will say, you know, I would include ADHD as well in this one, that have more, let me back that up, have higher highs, lower lows, as well as experience those intense emotions more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, because our brains are lighting up and you're having so many thoughts. And of course, those thoughts are triggering emotions as well as hormones. And so it's a lot happening. And one thing I would say specific to autism, I can be just going along happy as a plum, and then I get some bad news, or not even bad news, just like something negative happens. And then I can so quickly spiral into, I call them dark thoughts, but just
dark,
like,
thoughts. Okay.
Getting like so that. Upset about something. And because our brains are so connected, our neural pathways, that like one negative thing, my brain can find 20 supporting evidences for that really fast.
Yeah.
And so it can just, yeah, go downhill really fast.
Yeah. And so if you're in a relationship, a couple relationship, and you don't understand that the emotions that your partner might be feeling or showing or sharing aren't personal, that it's because both of your brains are wired differently, and there may be trauma, and there may be other, you know, childhood wounds. There's all kinds of stuff that might be in play here. But if you understand yourself, right, like you're saying, there might be 20 plus different dark thoughts that you're experiencing after hearing one negative thing. What can someone who's going down that path, if there's something you can suggest, do so they notice that and then can do something differently?
Yeah. Well, I will say, in the context of, let's say, two partners are having a discussion and then one says something that the other finds hurtful.
Yeah.
Let's say that person's autistic. And that person can immediately, so unbeknownst to their partner, the autistic person is like thinking of 20 connecting events, and suddenly they're feeling like, I'm an awful person and this is never going to get better. And their partner's looking at them having no idea how dark this got and why they're suddenly crying. And furthermore, when our minds get to that state, it's like, it's hard to explain. It's almost,
I would say, like, it's catastrophizing. I would say it's catastrophizing because I watched it for my entire marriage. I don't know if this makes sense to you. The catastrophizing that went on in my ex-husband's mind was mind-blowing to me. Talk about dark thoughts. I mean, I just couldn't understand how from one second to the next he could get to where he got to. And does that resonate at all? I'm just speaking about my experience with.
I guess I just have personal issues with the word catastrophizing.
Okay, another word. I love this, Jackie.
I know, right? But I do want to say where that comes from, because catastrophizing is a common word used in cognitive behavioral therapy, where you identify illogical thought patterns. You're catastrophizing. So the reason I don't like using that is because we autistics cannot identify that is what we're doing. In the moment, it feels very, very real. And if you try to point out to us that it's catastrophizing, we will get very upset. And we will give you lots of evidence that you are wrong. And here's why. And like,
you're talking about my marriage. Yes. And then it becomes, as my friend and colleague Bron Wilson calls, the communication roundabout or the conflict roundabout.
Yes.
You never get off. Go ahead.
But here's the other truth about this is that autistics, once we've hit that state, there's that emotional overwhelm state. There's really no reasoning with us.
Right.
Or for us to reason with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so really one of the best things we can do is pause is almost too short of a word. You really are ending the conversation for at least a night.
Right.
And that you if you're the autistic, distract yourself in some capacity so that you're not continuing down that dark thought path. And really, it does take a night's worth of sleep for your body to metabolize all those hormones, for you to calm down. And then the next day, it's so strange. It's like you can look back on it and you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. And you can see it with so much more logic than it's. So really what's happening is you have access to your executive functioning again.
Right. And that's where there can be continued conflict with somebody who's not autistic. And you're like, how can you just be over that major blow up that we just had where I was on the verge of divorce and you were about ready to, you know, walk out and sell our house because you found one patch of mold in the bathroom. I mean, these are the things that, you know, can create havoc. So again, just light bulbs going off in my head, and I'm sure a lot of the other listeners, and I do want to get to the other category. So that was just so helpful. How about the sensory piece? Oh my gosh. I wish I had known. So tell me a little bit about what you've discovered and what you've helped folks do with the sensory category.
Yes. So the sensory category is basically that autistics have enhanced sensory systems, meaning we frequently hear better, see better, smell better. Okay, better sounds like such a weird comparison word, but really compared to the average human.
Right.
So for example, I, for the longest time, thought I had a hearing problem because when I was in a group of people, or like, let's say at a restaurant, I couldn't hear who was in front of me.
Oh my gosh, Jackie.
But really, when I went to get my hearing tested, I actually hear far better than the average person. Mm-hmm. And so what was happening, or what continues to happen, is that I hear everything else in that restaurant so well that I can't hear the person in front of me.
Right.
And that is very common for autistics, that it's such an assault on our senses. It's hard to stay present.
Yeah.
It's hard to not get agitated, as well as it's exhausting. It is physically and mentally exhausting.
Yeah. And so again, taking it back to a couple, what you just said about being in a restaurant or a bar or whatever, I remember when I was separated from my ex and he told me just that. He said, I think I'm losing my hearing. I can't hear people when they're right next to me talking. And now I understand what was going on. And the challenge is sometimes when we don't know that our partner is autistic or autistic ADHD, we think that they are exaggerating or, right?
Yeah,
we think that, or I can say from speaking for myself, I thought that my ex was exaggerating, or I thought, you know, put on your big boy pants and just deal with it. Right.
Yeah.
And I hear from folks that going to restaurants and having to look at a menu, the Cheesecake Factory is like hell, you know, the menu there is like, I don't know, 20 pages. Being able to look before you go to a restaurant to see if there's seating where you are not overly stimulated. All of those things can make all the difference, right?
Yes. As well as like even in a restaurant, the lights, right? Like bright lights are so painful and like many of us to get headaches and migraines. And so just there's so many factors. And so, yes, we are capable of sucking it up and getting through that hour. But we can't do that hour upon hour upon hour. It eventually just saps us.
Right. At what cost?
Exactly.
And that's where I advise couples in the support group that you need to understand what your sensory profile is and be able to talk about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can go online and find
that. I like that word.
I love it. For both partners, right?
Yeah.
So if there are certain scents, certain lights, certain sounds, certain music, too many TVs, all those things. And it may not be just the autistic partner, you know, your partner may have sensory issues that they aren't even aware of, but that definitely takes their nervous system to a place they don't necessarily want it to go. So all that's important. Find out what your sensory profile is, share that with your partner, and then make plans together so that you don't feel, you know, over regulated or too sensitive and walk in and have what should be a very romantic dinner turn into a disaster or a family event, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of family events, right? So we're coming upon the holidays. I'm not sure when this is going to be released, but I know we are recording it right after Thanksgiving. So the social category is another big challenge, I think, for couples who don't understand. What are some of the things you can share about that?
What I really like to emphasize with social is that I don't see autism directly causing social problems. It's not like, oh, autistic, you're autistic, so you're destined to fail socially.
What I agree. It
is that our differences, for instance, what we've discussed about a restaurant with the sensory system, makes socializing more challenging for us in some areas. So like we mentioned, like a physical environment. So like Thanksgiving in my family is a massive family reunion, lots of people, very overstimulating. And I had such a hard time having meaningful conversations because I could barely hear the person. I was like guessing every fourth word. So I wasn't as adept at socializing in that context. However, if someone pulls me aside into a quiet room, well, it was usually me pulling them aside so I could hear. But like then I'm incredibly social and very good at interacting. And so with all the social things, I really try to help people identify what is making that social situation challenging. It's not just environment, right? Like,
right.
It's like what you said, what we were talking about with the emotional characteristics, like
right.
maybe that person's hit a point of overwhelm. And so they can't continue the conversation, which is of course disruptive.
Right. My father used to get up from the table. Well, first he always asked, because my mother, I think, used to get annoyed at him. We'd be talking at dinner, and it was a really important time for me, you know, because we process our days and whatever. And I think what happened, because we learned that my father was autistic, he passed away a long time ago, but he would say, "Can I be excused?" Now, when I think about it, you know, he had enough of the small talk with his wife and two daughters, and he needed to excuse himself, go into the other room so he could smoke his cigarettes and watch sports or news or whatever. He didn't, mm-hmm. he was done socializing. And, yeah. and he learned how to say that in a very kind and nice way without just getting up and walking out, which I've heard a lot of folks talk about, you know, their partners at social events, they just get up, walk out, or they fall asleep, or they just spend the entire time. Entire time on their phone.
Oh, I think that's actually huge now, the one with the phone, because it's a more socially acceptable way to be apart.
Yeah.
Although personally, for me, if I'm trying to talk to someone and they're on their phone, I'm like, ah!
I know. So the social piece, again, you've given a lot of examples and good ideas. And one of the terms that I took from somebody who's been on the podcast before, your social quota, understanding how much you can socialize in any particular situation. And when you feel like you're getting dysregulated or overloaded, you know, to be able to communicate that to your partner or to understand yourself that you need a break. And my ex used to go to the bathroom, and I don't think he was in the bathroom for an hour or longer. He just needed to get away and re-regulate. And and now, God bless him, what a great idea, because nobody's gonna come bother you, you know. They think you're taking care of your business. So there's an idea for those of you that need to get away at family events. Just go to the bathroom, close the door, hopefully there's more than one bathroom, or go for a walk, right?
Well, that's something else I would like to emphasize with this is, you know, we keep talking about like, oh, when you're getting overwhelmed, do this, do that. But ideally, we're also learning enough about ourselves that we preempt those things. Amen. So for example, myself, like, I will take a break before I've reached my limit, so that it's still an enjoyable experience for me. Wonderful. And so it's not just like, ah, Jackie's freaking out. Jackie is exiting.
Right.
I get away while things are still good.
Yes.
You know, have a minute to myself and then come back, and I can keep going in a conversation, you know, I want to be having.
Right. Beautiful. And that's where that self-awareness and understanding is so critical. And then accepting that we're all different. We all have differently wired brains. And if we can understand ourselves, then we can be more gracious with ourselves when we're in situations that we may respond or react differently than others, and not judge ourselves. Because I know we do that, don't we?
This reminded me, one other thing I would say for this category too, is that the more you understand yourself, the more you can begin to articulate your needs to others.
Yes.
And that makes a huge difference when others understand. They don't take it personally if you step out to take a break.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I know there are couples and individuals from all over the world listening to this podcast, and I know it's going to be helpful. And for those of you that are looking to understand your partner better, if you don't know, and I'm going to send both of these to you, Jackie, I have the Neurodiverse Love conversation cards. They can be purchased on my website. They're $11. It's a digital download of 52 questions. And then I just put out the Neurodiverse Love Conversation Card Workbook, which is another 52 questions. So there's 104 questions in there. And those are the questions I wish my ex-husband and I had asked each other. Every single relationship after, I've asked a lot of those questions because I want to understand my partner. I want to be able to support them, and I want them to understand me too. So for folks, I'll put that in the show notes, but I'm going to send them to you, Jackie, so you can.
Oh, I'm excited. I want to do them with my husband.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, because also, like, I as an autistic, I don't always know how I'm impacting someone else. And so I think something like cards would be a nice way to engage in some conversations and bring things up that I may not be aware of.
Yeah. Oh, Thank you. That's great. And I think the emotional piece was for me the most difficult piece because I didn't understand how overly emotional I was and how that impacted my ex-husband. And I remember the guy I dated after my divorce said to me, "If you were any more emotional, I don't know that we could be together." And at the time, wow. He's autistic too. And at the time, I didn't understand how emotional I was. And I was on Cymbalta at the time. So I was even less emotional than I was in my marriage. But you learn, you keep learning. So the other two are mental and body. So, you know, both sides. So I'd love to talk a little bit about the mental category.
Yes, I think it's funny because I actually just loaded up an essay for my blog about the 10 most impactful thinking characteristics. But two that I emphasize a lot are the constellation thinking. So again, that one thought can lead to like 100 other thoughts. Mm-hmm. And then also the multi-layered thinking. Mm-hmm. So when I'm in conversation with someone, I can also be analyzing how the conversation is going. I'm not choosing to do that. It's weird. It's like my brain, it's like a background program running, being like, am I making enough eye contact? Am I asking enough questions? Am I, and this is common for autistics. It's this other level that in some ways is really good and in some ways can be very challenging.
It sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many autistic individuals I have had share the same thing. And I love the constellation thinking and the multi-layered thinking, using those words to describe it, because just using those words helped me understand what was going on in my partner's brains that I didn't understand. And sometimes it would look like there might be quiet or that deer in headlights look, right? And yep. I was like, did I lose you? Where are you going? Yeah. Why aren't you responding? And now I understand, and I've understood for years, but I love the terms you're using, because when we understand that our partner hasn't left us, you know, that they're engaging in their own thoughts and mental, you know, exploration, I'm going to say, then we don't have to take it personally, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you've noted that, because I've had like people who know me well enough can recognize the look in my eye when I've essentially spaced out. And I'm not spacing out like I'm bored. I'm not. If anything, what the person said to me is so interesting that my brain is like exploding with thoughts. And so I'm just trying to kind of, I don't know. It's like my brain's taking its time to like, be like, okay, where do we go next? Which of these thoughts is most important?
Right. And again, we can have so much compassion and give our partners space and time to like process in ways that we don't, and we may not have understood until we hear somebody explain it in a way that makes sense, which is what you are doing. I mean, it just makes so much sense. Anything else about the mental before we go to the body, which is the last one?
We can go on. I mean, there's more tons, about everything.
I know. And I want to tell folks that you do have a blog, and we'll give everybody your website information at the end, and we're almost at the end, but let's talk about the body, and then we can talk about a few more things before we close out.
The body is that there's a lot of correlations with some challenges within the body. So for instance, interoception, which is your ability to sense, for instance, when you're hungry or when you're full, or that you need to drink water. So for many autistics, for instance, if I suddenly I'm like, ooh, I need to go to the bathroom, but then I start writing and like I'm like, oh, but let me finish this thought on my essay, and then I'm like, oh, I get lost in it in terms of like, oh, I have more to say.
Right.
I can go on and forget for 2-3 hours that I needed to go to the bathroom.
Right.
It's like my mind takes over and shuts off my body's senses.
Right.
Or for instance, I might, my leg might go dead and I don't even notice it because I'm so lost.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not lost in a bad way. Like it's enjoyable.
Right.
So the same is external, where with proprioception, which is our ability to sense our body in space.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, I bump into a lot more things, or right. I drop things, or, and again, it's just, I think our minds are coping with so much that it's hard for it to discern what's most important, essentially.
Yeah.
And now that I've said those, I do want to say one more really important one that I hear in almost every single autistic client, and that is digestive problems.
Mm-hmm.
And studies show that at least 70% of autistics experience some form of digestive pain.
Mm-hmm.
And there's multiple theories about that. One huge one is the gut-brain axis, where if we're stressed, which as an autistic, there's a million things that activate our nervous system, and that can then throw our digestive system into dysregulation. And for me as a kid, you know, I was constantly being told, like, oh, why are you so sensitive about, like, things I ate? But, like, really, it was just really hard. And I hear that a lot with other autistics that, it's challenging.
Yeah. And I hear that often. I saw that in my marriage, and I see that with a lot of other folks. And it can be a very embarrassing thing, you know, and understanding the mind-gut connection, I think, can be really helpful going to a functional medicine doctor and maybe realizing that there are some foods that are not good for your body and not easy for you to digest, but also going to a functional medicine doctor and maybe a holistic therapist or an expressive art therapist. Somebody who can look at things through a more holistic lens can help you. So,
well, can I also add with that? Sometimes it feels like we as autistics are searching for the holy grail. Like, if I could just find the one thing wrong with my digestive system, I could fix it. But really, the way our systems work is they go through periods. So, for instance, you might go through a period where you can't tolerate gluten, but mm-hmm. then you go through another period where it doesn't bother you at all. And that's because the nervous system is always in flux. And so I just want to say to any fellow autistic out there that, like, you're not losing your mind.
Yeah.
Like, it really does fluctuate. And so, like, for instance, right now I'm on an anti-anxiety medication for my digestive system.
Mm.
And it's made a world of difference. And so, will I always need that? No. But right now, as I, you know, I just got married, I'm about to go to India for 3 weeks.
Right.
A lot of stress. So it really helps.
Yeah. And sometimes, thank you for sharing that. Sometimes, you know I fought going on Cymbalta, which is an anti-anxiety, antidepressant, for many, many years. And I think if I had gone on it before, it might have helped. I had really horrible postpartum depression for 2 years after our daughter was born. And I think, you know, I am not pro medicine. I am not pro, you know, therapy. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there are sometimes periods in our life where we need extra help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as a social worker, I, you know, fought it. My parents, I was raised by two psychologists. Why can't I just figure this stuff out myself?
Yeah.
Because I couldn't. And sometimes we need help, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's okay.
Yes. I actually wrote a whole essay about that. Like, have I failed as an autistic because I need medication?
Oh.
Short answer, no.
Okay. Well, that's great. So before you tell folks where to find you, because Jackie, this conversation has been just phenomenal for me, and I know it's going to be for the Neurodiverse Love community. I know when we met, you said you had a misdiagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd love if you would share kind of what your thoughts are about that, especially for folks that are born female at birth. I know that this is a challenge for a lot of folks. What do you want to share with the folks out there that think they might be autistic but have been diagnosed with something else. And now after hearing from you, they're like, or reading a book, they're like, I don't think I'm borderline personality disorder. I don't have borderline personality disorder, whatever. So what are your thoughts that you want to share with folks about that?
Yeah, for one, the two most common misdiagnoses for autistics are borderline personality disorder, as you mentioned, and bipolar disorder.
Right, right.
And part of the issue is that our medical system does not spend sufficient time with us many times when they're assessing. So for instance, when I went for my assessment, and it wasn't just, I just wanted help. It was right after my mom died. I was just in a period of utter depression and I was like, I need help. And I spent 20 minutes with a psychiatrist and was told I had borderline personality disorder.
Wow.
And I look back at that and think, what an injustice that was. Like how, and a lot of the traits of borderline personality disorder, I think many autistics experience because we don't know we're autistic. So for instance, one is that you feel empty. Well, yeah, if you have an overwhelming experience of the world and you don't know why, of course you're going to be like confused and feel empty and that something's wrong with you. And of course you're going to jump from job to job or jump from relationship to relationship. Like, I didn't have a successful relationship until I knew I was autistic. I mean, hasn't been that long, but it's so, but really it's my longest relationship now. Sure. And the most peaceful by far.
Wow. And, you know, just you saying that, it makes me like want to hold my heart for you, because I hear this over and over again, how much folks have struggled in relationship, whether it's with a parent or a sibling or a boss or somebody they cared about or loved, was married to, lived with, or was dating, because they didn't understand themselves. They couldn't explain to their partner what they needed. Their partner judged them. And I'm raising both hands, Jackie, because I did it throughout my marriage. I judged. And that unintentional hurt and pain and even trauma create such havoc for the neurodivergent person, for the people in their lives. Because when we love people or we care about them, unless you have a serious, serious, serious mental health issue or personality disorder, you don't want to hurt the people that you care about. You don't want to hurt the people that you love.
Yeah.
And when you keep doing it, you know, whoever is in the relationship, because you don't understand yourselves, yourself individually or your partner, gosh, you know, sometimes I wish I could go back in time and I could be a nicer person. I could be less judgmental. I could be more compassionate. I could give my ex more space in thinking and processing, but I can't. None of us can go back in time, but we can be better if we're still in relationship with that person that we've hurt unintentionally, or in future relationships, which is what I have done. And, you know, all this knowledge can make you a better partner. It certainly has made me a better partner and mother and sister and everything else that I've done in my life. So Jackie,
Wait. Yes. I have got to comment on that.
Any last comments? Go ahead.
Yeah. I also feel I was a very judgmental person, and in many ways still am dismantling that about myself. And I think that was because, you know, I was being told, you know, Jackie, don't do that, Jackie, do this. Like, I mean, my mother told me that she had to work harder with me than any of the other siblings. And I think I internalized that, and then also then would expect other people to, like, no, that's not the right way to behave. Like, you're supposed to do it this way.
Right.
And so, I'm just glad you really mentioned that like we do unintentionally cause harm. And that is part of the process of learning about your autistic identity. Is it's not just, looking at how you've been treated, and it's also looking at how you've treated others. mm-hmm. and how to change, as well as how you've treated yourself and how to change that.
Amen. I 100% agree. And I think a lot of us, we want our partners to change when they are different than us. And yeah. I say this over and over again, we need to look in the mirror and yeah. we need to look at how we can be better individuals, partners, whatever. And sometimes the partners that we're with, and we didn't know we were in a neurodiverse relationship, are no longer the right partners for us. And I know that was the hardest decision that I ever had to make in my life. And I say this on the podcast, and it's, you know, why I do the podcast, because I want others to know that making that decision was literally the hardest decision, to divorce my ex-husband, because we both still loved each other. But I knew that we couldn't heal together. I knew that there had been too much pain, unintentional, but too much pain.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best thing that you can do is leave a relationship, or if you both are willing to grow, first heal, forgive, and then grow together, you can have a better relationship than you even imagined. So yeah. Any thoughts on that before you give your contact information?
No, I mean, I just want to say thank you for doing the work you're doing. I think some of our most wonderful and painful experiences occur in relationship with others.
Amen. 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 We can hurt beyond any hurt that we have ever experienced, but we can yeah. also grow and yeah. become the best version of ourselves if we're willing to look in the mirror. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. So Jackie, I know, you know, you're going, you said, to India for, to celebrate your marriage to your husband. And I know
we're getting married a second time.
Second time.
Doing the Hindu rituals now.
So that should be exciting. And yeah. I would love for you to share how people can contact you, but also I know you have books, you've been on other podcasts, you do a blog. Share a little bit about what you have available to folks and where they can find it.
Yes. The easiest place to find all my stuff is on my website, which is www.jackieschull.com. Just my name.
Yeah.
And I link to everything there because I also do a blog. I do just various projects from time to time. But I guess the one other thing I'd like to highlight is my book is coming out on January 29th of 2024. Yay. So I don't know when this will be released, but it's called Life as a Late Identified Autistic. And it goes through those six categories, as well as some other aspects of autism. So
fantastic. Yes, this will be released before your book comes out. So people can, people can get your book. I'm guessing it'll be available where books are sold, or does it have to be through your website?
Oh, well, yeah, it'll be on Amazon for sure. And then I will work on getting it other places.
Okay, fantastic. So, and this is a question sometimes I forget to ask on the podcast, but I know you only do therapy. You don't do coaching.
I don't.
Is that correct? Okay.
Correct.
And so you're in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So folks would have to.
Actually, I know where you're going with this. I'm a registered expressive art therapist. I see clients from all over the world.
Okay. That's where I was going. Yes.
Because I don't operate under my mental health counseling license.
Okay. Fantastic. So people can reach out to you and they can work with you. But remember, Jackie does not work with couples.
Sorry.
She works with individuals, primarily autistic or neurodivergent folks. Do you work with non-autistic or non-neurodivergent folks?
I have in the past, but now my practice is solely devoted to those who are wondering if they might be autistic or ADHD.
Okay, fantastic. Jackie, this conversation has been amazing. I am so excited that you're out there doing the work that you're doing. And I know there are going to be a lot of folks who are going to reach out to you. It happens every time I have an amazing guest. They get folks that want to work with them. So for those of you that have found what Jackie has shared interesting, I hope you'll get her book when it comes out at the end of January, but I also hope you'll reach out to her and maybe have an opportunity to work with her in the future. Jackie, thank you for all you're doing. Congratulations on your second, you know, wedding ceremony in India. I hope everything goes well.
Yeah.
Beautifully, in fact. And I just really appreciate you and sharing your expertise and your time with the NeuroDiverse Love community. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.